And with a look at the backcountry and the fun with us, we've got Nikki from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center. Good morning.
Good morning. So it finally feels like winter returned to the mountains. It's snowing lightly, and we've got about 2 to 6 inches of new snow so far, and we should get another 2 to 4 before the snowfall stops, bringing our snowfall to about 4 to 9 inches of snow today. The main thing today is the winds. They've really picked up overnight. They're blowing from 15 to 20 miles per hour at mid elevations, but gusting between 40 and 60 miles per hour at these upper elevations and likely moving quite a bit of snow around. Yesterday, there weren't any new avalanches reported in the backcountry. Ski resorts do continue to report some wet, loose activity throughout the day. Today, we're actually going to have 3 issues to think about. So the first is that wind I talked about. So the westerly winds continue to blow across the upper elevations near 60 miles per hour, and they now have a little bit of new snow to move around. So expect to see shallow drifts of wind-blown snow at the upper elevations. The winds are primarily from the west, which means they'll deposit snow on the eastern aspects, but with such high winds, we could see snow drifts at all aspects at upper elevations and on those eastern aspects at mid elevations. Look for any obvious signs of wind drift with snow. Avoid those slopes. The second thing to think about is going to be that new snow. So in areas that aren't affected by the snow, look for some fast running sloughs. With such warm temperatures yesterday, the snow surface was likely damp, which would cause the new snow to bond well to it. But if the snow surface was able to freeze before that new snow fell, there will be a firm crust, and that could lead to some fast-running sloughs. They're not going to be large, but they could be big enough to knock you off your feet and sweep you through some complex terrain. And then finally, we want to think about the wet snow, which is what we've been talking about the last couple days. The clouds and cool temps should prevent wet activity today, but if the sun comes out at all, or we notice any greenhousing where the clouds trap warm temperatures, the wet snow could become quickly reactive. This includes both wet sloughs as well as larger slides. We haven't seen any of these wet slabs yet, but the snowpack's all saturated now, and if it becomes wet again today, we could see that at the low and mid elevations. Today, we're going to have an overall moderate danger due to the strong westerly winds with the new snow, creating unstable slabs of wind-drifted snow and long-running sloughs in areas not impacted by the wind. Today, have a flexible plan that allows you to respond to changing weather conditions.
Okay, Nikki, thank you. Well, stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Later on, Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator Nate Owens with details about how the state is working to stop the infestation of quagga mussels. Finally, Cheryl Fox, Director of Summit Land Conservancy, has an update on open space issues, including the preservation of the Huntsville Monastery. Well, the Summit County Council will be meeting virtually starting at 3:15 tomorrow. On the phone with a preview, I have Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
So at about 3:25, a discussion about the Snyderville Basin Recreation District short-term access trail plan. It's looking at 3 phases. First is reducing and regulating parking around trailheads that impacts neighborhoods. Are they planning anything new for this year?
Well, I think their main focus is really trying to disperse some of the use so that we don't see as much activity at the places where we've seen a lot of the problems, Rob's Trail or some of the trailheads up in Summit Park. The interesting thing is that they've collected a huge amount of data that is contained in the staff report, which shows what is happening and where we're having the issues and what time of day we're having the issues. But this will be the first year that we'll have enforcement running full time throughout the full season. And also we may try some different methods of getting people up to those trailheads from some central parking lots if that works.
Yeah, the second phase then will be to improve accesses in areas that wouldn't impact neighborhoods. One example they gave is the new Discovery Trailhead. Any other spots they're thinking about?
Well, there's several, and I did not get down to the detail in that report to notice that, but it looks like they're also looking at improving some of the parking or adding some parking in perhaps some of the trailheads in, around Glenwild or in Round Valley as well, the ones that are under the regulation of Snyderville Basin.
And then in the third phase is to provide alternate transit to the trailheads. And we've talked about this before. And what we've heard from listeners is that it would be much more effective if people could take their dogs on transit. Is that part of the plan?
We know that's an issue. I don't know if it'll actually be the same type of vehicle that will be, part of our public transit system. We'll have to see how that progresses. And so whether that can happen with pets or not. Certainly pets along on trails with their owners is a big deal. So we're going to have to deal with that as well.
Okay, and what's the idea? I mean, how long does it take to implement this short-term plan?
Well, I think short-term is meant to look at this year. This main season, so the shoulder season at the beginning, summer, and then fall. And then I think during that time, they're going to be looking at more longer-term solutions as well. So really, this talks about what we can get done this year and put in place to see, and then to, of course, test the effectiveness of that. To guide us into the future years.
And any idea what it's going to cost to implement the plan?
I don't have those figures in front of me, no.
And are they specifically looking for direction from council?
Absolutely. I mean, the council is the governing board of the rec district. They certainly want to keep the council informed along the way and get any further ideas from them or any feedback that the council is hearing from the public about the plans that the rec district is putting in place.
All right. Then about 5:10, a discussion regarding a 30-lot master plan development in the Wansatch area. What's the council being asked to decide here, if anything?
Well, it's interesting. This is more getting some advice from the council on how they want to bring the thing forward. There's a couple of issues with this. There's both the subdivision itself and the master plan development, which is one process, and then there is the collected wastewater piece of this. Which the council is also the governing board of the wastewater district on the east part of the county. So, do they bring both of those items together on the same agenda as separate items? Are they the same item? Or do we break them up sequentially so the council's not dealing with it all at once? That's what they're going to be talking to the council about today.
All right. The council is returning to discuss two big connected items that were postponed a couple of weeks ago because of a mistake in the noticing, the neighborhood mixed-use zone. So any changes here?
Well, I mean, the council did end up discussing more of the NMU, even though they delayed the MPD public hearing because of the noticing problem. They did still spent about an hour discussing the NMU, so there was a little bit more direction to staff. So I'm sure that discussion will continue, and then we'll hear the public hearing and then a further discussion on the MPD.
Okay, and then again, the hearing on the MPD process, which will help supply details about how the neighborhood mixed-use zone is being implemented. It does seem like the MPD includes some new details. It includes a rezone of 10 residential units or more, uses from commercial to public to industrial of 10,000 square feet or more. Why these changes?
Well, these changes were a result of the last time the general plan was changed, and this was projected to be implemented in order to allow something different than what the community commercial, which was already allowed, that zone, allow more of that neighborhood mixed use zone to happen within very specific parts of the unincorporated county in the Snyderville Basin. So those details are fairly specific to the implementation of the neighborhood mixed use zone.
Okay. As we've been reporting, the state's mask mandate, of course, due to expire at midnight April 10th at their last meeting, the Summit County Council agreed with Health Director Rich Bolo not to continue with a limited mask order. Last night, opinions about that decision, though, divided at the County Board of Health meeting, with a majority of the board members favoring continuing a mask mandate if they could, and included a county council member who was absent last week. So, any idea if this issue could get reopened at the council meeting tomorrow?
Well, it's possible. It's not agendaed, so I don't believe they will be talking about it officially, but, you know, it's possible during council comments that some discussion happens. There has been some discussion between the county attorney's office and the governor's office over the last week, which has brought some further clarity to the issue of whether counties can or cannot put a health order in place past the April 10th date. Appears that they can, according to the governor's office, and they will be entertaining those if they come forward. So I think there is something for the council to discuss, and I expect it will happen. I'm not sure what the format of that will be at this point.
Yeah, and I guess what we're hearing from businesses, you know, who would like to maybe see it open is like, you know, it's been easy these past few months, several months, where, you know, they could just say, hey, it's county order, so wear your mask inside our store. Now you're asking the store, the business owner, to, you know, make that decision for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And the hard part is that to add a further level of complexity is if the county did decide to work with the governor's office to keep a health order in place for masking, it only can last until the last threshold of doing away with all health orders that the legislature has put in place per law is met, which is that about 1.6 million vaccinations have been allocated to the state. And we still expect that to happen sometime last week of April, first week of May. So, you know, it's that dilemma of, do you put something in place and go through that effort and communicate it and, you know, work with everybody for a 2 to 3 week period. But then there's the counter argument, which is, you know, the longer we can keep it in place, the longer that we keep people safer. So, and it's a policy direction now that we're waiting for from the council, if they want to change anything from last week.
All right. Hey, I'm also seeing a lot of chatter on social media that the Park City Fire District apparently wants to take over the North Summit Fire District. Can you tell us what's going on here? I mean, of course, the county council also oversees all of these special service districts.
Yeah, there is absolutely no discussion at the county level where districts are regulated about anything regarding the Park City Fire District taking over the North Summit Fire District. I think there's some confusion about how emergency medical services are provided within the county, and those are all provided under a contract with the Park City Fire District. Both the Snyderville Basin or the Park City area emergency medical services, and then of course the East County, and that's done under two contracts for both North and South Summit. That's a decision of the council based on how the state law is currently set up and who holds the licenses and several other factors. So, you know, there is a lot of discussion about the future of EMS and whether the fire districts on the east side of the county could take over those services in the future. Those discussions are ongoing between mayors, the council, and the districts themselves. And you'll note that there's also the complexity that the North Summit Fire District is a special service district underneath the county. and the South Summit Fire District is an independent district with independent elected board members. So it gets complicated as we get into that EMS discussion.
All right. So again, there is a contract with the Park City Fire District to provide all of the emergency medical services for both North and South Summit?
That is correct.
All right. And it sounds like North Summit may want to take that back. I mean, can they do that unilaterally or no?
They can't do it unilaterally. It would have to be a community decision along with, you know, essentially the county council would have to make that decision at the end of the day. There's several things that would have to be in place. First of all, the North Summit Fire District would have to be able to get licensure in order to be able to do that. And then, of course, they would have to have, you know, the tax base and the budget to be able to do that. Right now, the county collects not a specific mill levy, but underneath its general mill levy is where EMS services are paid for at the current level of service. So if different levels of service were being asked for in changing any management of the EMS service, of course, that would have to be dealt with in a budgetary truth and taxation type of way, too, with the North Summit Fire District. So I think there's a lot of discussion going on. Of course, we've got a fairly new chief with the North Summit Fire District, who has been with the North Summit Fire District for less than a year, as well as a newly sat board that has been in place for they'll have their third meeting of the year this at the end of this week. So I think there's some really good questions being asked by the community about provision of fire service and EMS service. And we're in the mode of being open about how we do things and providing a lot of education so people understand the complexity of that decision.
Yeah, so there are no ambulances then stationed in North and South Summit?
Oh, yes, there is. Okay. In fact, there's several ambulances staged within those areas and one in each area that's manned 24 hours a day. So that is a service that has grown and matured over the last few years. At least I've seen it change several times since I've been the county manager. And I think there's a perception that there's a big difference in service, and there is from the standpoint of population density and what's needed. If higher levels of service are wanted, then there's a lot of different things that need to be discussed in order to do that, or if a change in the way that we provide that service and who runs it. Certainly the Park City Fire District is contracted to do all that, and all of the EMTs that work both on the east side of the county and within the Park City area are all employees of the Park City Fire District.
All right. So, I mean, even though the ambulances are there, are the staff there as well? And the reason I ask is because there was just some discussion about a recent death that happened in Camas that may have been prevented if somebody didn't have to travel 20 minutes to get there.
Yeah, it was. There's a. You know, I'm going to allow the fire chiefs to speak on that specific case because I don't have all the details. I have heard that the EMS board, the last EMS board meeting, where the chiefs meet and a couple of the mayors and the medical director, as well as county staff and the health director meet to review EMS cases and EMS policy to make recommendations. They've reviewed that case and made some adjustments, but yes, EMS ambulances are staffed 24 hours a day in both the North and South Summit area. But there's challenges. I mean, the challenge of keeping EMTs on staff has grown over the last couple of years. And there perhaps is some desire by those on the east side of the county to have more volunteer base available within their communities, which has been a challenge in the last few years. So these things are being discussed very heavily.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to mention, Tom?
Just want to honor the service of Robert Taylor, our retiring building inspector, and Chad Wright out of our engineer office. Several decades of service to the county and the public by between the two of them, and just want to thank them for their service.
All right. Thanks for your time this morning, Tom.
Thank you.
Looks like we've got some snow-packed roads coming over Parley's Summit. It looks like traffic is moving a little bit better than it was about 20 minutes ago. Still slow going, and unfortunately many of the cameras not operating to kind of give you a better picture of what's happening. But several accidents there at the top of Parley's Summit, which has created very slow going. Looks like we've got another accident there at the US 40 and I-80 westbound ramp, which is impacting a couple of lanes there, and then also on US 40 westbound there, just looks like just prior to, so more like the Mayflower entrance there. As we've reported, the state's mask mandate due to expire at midnight April 10th. The Summit County Council at their last meeting agreed with Health Director Rich Bullen not to continue with a limited mask order. However, opinions about the decision were divided at last night's meeting of the County Health Board, a majority of board members favoring continuing that mask mandate if they could, and that included a county council member who was absent last week. KPCW's Rick Bruff has more on that.
Recent legislation, HB 294, set the date when the state's mask order would be lifted. After the 10th, the county could enact a local health order, which would require masks just in cases where 50 or more people gather without social distancing. However, such a health order must be rescinded if three metrics are met. If the state's 14-day case rate falls below 191 per 100,000 people, the seven-day average for ICU utilizations is less than 15%, or if over 1.6 million doses of vaccine have been allocated to the state. Rich Bullis said last week those metrics have been met or are expected to be met by mid-May. The council decided not to extend a mask order. However, Councilmember Roger Armstrong had to be absent last week. Armstrong is the council liaison on Health Board. He told the group Monday night he'd prefer to keep a mask order in place through the shoulder season up until June while vaccinations continue, although he noted the state law may not allow that.
If we did get another surge, which we're seeing in other parts of the country, and we do have a lot of people that come here to recreate, we have a much larger workforce that comes here to work in and out of Summit County. So while our residents are pretty well protected, we're still going to be a principal source of spread to other places if we rescind that too soon. And I'm concerned about it. We want to have a conversation about whether to apply it just in the tourist-rich areas, which would be the Snyderville Basin versus the east side. Happy to have that discussion, but I am concerned about it.
Health Board member Dr. Alyssa Golding worried about the consequences of lifting the mask order.
I think it's so hard to walk things back once we remove the mask mandate. What if we had to reimpose it because there was a surge after all of the spring break related travel? So hard to do. I don't think anybody's really ever, I have seen so few places throughout the entire country kind of go backwards with stuff and reimpose things. They sort of just crossed their fingers and gritted their teeth and hope for the best. That's my concern. And I agree. I would say why not extend it as long as you can legally do so.
Board member Doug Evans agreed. He added that the state legislation just arbitrarily set the date of April 10th.
They came up with that date a long time ago. I would have rather have seen something based on some measurable metrics that when you achieve a certain level, then you can drop the mask mandate. It kind of goes counter to what we've been doing for the last year, where we've been trying to achieve certain goals and objectives and trying to reach these. And I was more upset with they just picked this date. And then they said, we've got to get back to normal. It's that attitude, that non-scientific attitude that bothers me.
But on the other hand, board member Chris Yoris said the responsibility should be placed with the businesses and their customers. He said that doesn't mean citizens are going to run free and wild, as he put it.
Okay, let's give the power back to the businesses and get government out of our lives. I mean, I know it's not what most of you want to hear, but we need to get these businesses back open and we need to let them run. And people are still going to wear masks. I mean, it's about freedom. And if they want to wear a mask or if they choose not to wear a mask, so be it. But if I'm going to go into a Home Depot or a Lowe's or a Walmart and they have a sign on their door that says, we require masks, I'm going to put a mask on and go in there, or I'm not going to go in there. It's all about property rights, and we need to give that back to these businesses and let them get going. They'll have the customers there. The people will respect their rights.
And Mark Watterson noted that local schools under the law will retain mask orders until June. Given the county's strong vaccination numbers, he favored another priority.
And I hope that that's where we put a lot of our emphasis, you know, continued emphasis moving forward. To me, there's a certain amount of political capital that is spent on things like this. And I think that that political capital would be better spent in pushing the public to consider and to get their vaccination rather than potentially continuing a divisive fight over masks.
Summit County Health Board member Mark Watterson. For KPCW, I'm Rick Bruff.
In the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources, will be using a new method at Lake Powell this year in the fight against the invasive quagga mussels. On the phone with details is Nate Owens. He is the Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator with the DWR. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So it seems like we talk a lot about quagga mussels every spring when boats get back out on the lakes and reservoirs. So what is the plan to tackle the quagga mussels this year?
Yeah, well, we are very excited. Utah Division of Wildlife Resources has partnered with the National Park Service at Glen Canyon, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, and Clean Wake LLC to build the first hot water decontamination dip tank in the country. And that will be in use down at Lake Powell at the State Line launch ramp come May 1st.
So maybe just a step back and tell us why do we care about this species and why do we need to eradicate them?
Quagga mussels are the most economically impactful invasive species North America has ever seen. They cost tens of billions of dollars of damage annually nationwide. For Utah, they're particularly problematic in that if they were to infest many of our reservoirs here along the Wasatch Front, they could threaten our water supply and our water quality because they are renowned for their ability to clog up water infrastructure and pipes. So we need to do everything we can to make sure that they do not spread out of Lake Powell. And we feel like this new decontamination dip tank is going to be our primary go-to weapon to combat their spread.
Well, tell us more about this new mitigation system. I mean, we're just putting boats in hot water and that's enough?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So far up to this point, the last 15 years of our program, we've simply used hot water at 120 to 140 degrees to pump through all the raw water systems on all these watercraft leaving Lake Powell. We knew that based on the complexity of the boats that we continue to see, the number of boaters visiting Lake Powell every year, and those continue to rise, we needed a better system than the one we were currently using, mostly to process more boats more quickly, but also to provide a better customer experience to the boater. So rather than have all these different attachments and try and figure out these complex systems on these boats, we figured why not actually utilize the way they are used in the reservoir itself and build a giant tank full of hot water and have the boats operate as they would if they were out on the reservoir.
So how long do they have to stay in the hot water?
Typically, the dip tank is going to use water at a temperature of 105 to 110 degrees Fahrenheit. At that temperature, all you need is an exposure time of 45 seconds to 1 minute to kill all quagga mussels. So in reality, this system will allow us to fully decontaminate a complex wakeboard boat in under 5 minutes.
So that's still, I mean, you think about 5 minutes per boat on a busy holiday weekend. I mean, there's no way you're going to be able to get through all the boats, or are you?
We won't be able to get through all the boats, but just to put it into perspective, before this system, the way we were decontaminating boats prior to this, each of those boats would take 40 minutes to 1 hour. So we're essentially cutting that down to 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes. So we should be able to process more than double the number of boats we have been in the past. So that allows us to take care of decontaminating these boats at Lake Powell more than having to rely on some of these other sites like Deer Creek, Jordanelle, Utah Lake, that have to provide that decontamination down the road to that boater. So it keeps quagga mussels closer to the source rather than having that potentially spread elsewhere.
So this, you do feel like this is a proven quagga destroyer rather than just some kind of pilot program?
That is the hope, and we fully believe that. Obviously, this is the first time this has ever been attempted in the country, so we're excited to see it on the ground and operating at Lake Powell, providing that service to boaters. We have full confidence in it. We've done our tests up to this point. They've all been very successful. So we are envisioning that this is going to be a successful summer for this system, and our hope is that we can have more systems like this out on the landscape providing these services to boaters within the next couple of years.
All right. Is there a cost to boat owners to use it?
No, this service will be completely free to the boater, just as all of our decontamination services are.
So here in Utah, is Lake Powell the biggest source or the biggest problem with quagga mussels?
Yes, Lake Powell is the only reservoir in Utah that has quagga or their cousin zebra mussels. So that is our primary focus, although we are diligent because there are threats across the border in Nevada, in Arizona. So we continually see boats coming from some of these other infested regions that we also have to decontaminate.
And then what happens to the mussels? I mean, they're dipped into this hot water and then they just fall off the boat back into the lake?
So they once exposed to hot water, the mussels, if there are any adults on the boat, they will die and fall off. A lot of times we're more concerned with the larval form of mussels, which you can't really see. They're free floating in some of these systems like ballast tanks. Those will be killed by this hot water as well and then pumped back out. And then the dip tank has a giant filtration system on it that filters all those mussels out and any other particles in the water and completely turns over that water every 2 hours. So there's going to be fresh water constantly in that tank.
Is there just going to be just one tank, or is there going to be a tank at each of the marinas there?
We're going to start out with one tank, and that'll be a state line launch ramp. Because this is a pilot program, because it's never been seen or tried before, we want to make sure that it is successful and worth moving forward on. These tanks are expensive, so we need to make sure this works before we put the additional investment in of building more tanks.
Okay, and eventually, if they do work, you expect to see them at all of our lakes and reservoirs?
I would say our hope would be to have probably half a dozen or more of these on the landscape within the next 2 to 3 years. There is a lot of national interest on this because this would be revolutionary in the aquatic invasive species world. So if it does prove successful like we think it will, the likelihood of these showing up in other states within the next 5 years is very high as well.
And again, here at the reservoirs in Wasatch and Summit County, we don't have a problem with the mussels yet then?
No, we don't. We have a very robust watercraft inspection program. All these reservoirs along the Wasatch Front have inspection staff on site, whether it's the Utah Division of Wildlife or Utah Division of Parks and Recreation. We all have very dedicated, passionate staff that are making sure that our waters are protected.
Yeah. And then what about streams and rivers? Have they found their way there?
They have not. Streams and rivers are a little bit more challenging for quagga mussels to live in, although they are in the Colorado River, obviously Lake Powell, Lake Mead. the lower Colorado River is infested, but typically you see these in reservoirs and lakes just because they're transported primarily by recreational watercraft.
And the fact that we haven't really had boats in the water all winter, I mean, do these quagga mussels survive over the winter?
They do. They're originally native to the Black and Caspian Seas over in Eurasia. And then the first time they showed up in North America was in the Great Lakes. And the Great Lakes get much colder than anything we have around here. So they are a pretty hardy species, and they can survive freezing temperatures.
Okay. And again, so you hope to, I know you were doing some kind of demonstration in Ogden and then before moving it down to Lake Powell. When do you expect to have that in service?
Yeah, so yeah, we're doing a demonstration this Thursday at 10 a.m. out in Ogden at MJK Custom Fabrication and Coatings. That's mostly a media event and public outreach event. Then the tank will be transported down to Lake Powell within the next week. And our goal is to have that installed on the launch ramp at State Line and operational and available to boaters May 1st.
Wow. Okay. And you said these are expensive. What are we talking about?
This one is roughly $800,000. Because it's never been tried, there was a lot of tweaking, a lot of trial and error. We expect that cost to come down significantly now that one has been produced and we kind of know the ins and outs of this. And we believe that the time saving, the increase in the safety, the simplicity of the system, and the fact that it's future proof, regardless of how complex the wakeboard boats and some of these other boats end up being, we feel like this is a really solid investment in the future of our program and the protection of water infrastructure in Utah.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to tell us about that, Nate?
Just like to remind voters to clean, drain, and dry. That's the primary message we've been preaching for all these years, and it's still the most effective method to make sure that our reservoirs are protected from quagga and zebra mussels.
Okay. Fingers crossed that it works. Thanks for your time, Nate.
Great. Thank you.
And Nate Owens is the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources Aquatic Invasive Species Coordinator. Well, the Summit Land Conservancy has partnered with the Ogden Valley Land Trust to protect the Huntsville Monastery. In the studio with details, the Executive Director of the Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
Great to see you.
It's great to be here.
So what's being saved here?
So there has been a Trappist monastery. It's a Catholic monastery up in the Ogden Valley near Huntsville. It was there for 70 years. It was founded in 1947 by a group of Trappist monks. Many of them were veterans from World War II. And for 70 years, they farmed this and ranched this beautiful land up in the Ogden Valley. They chose that place because at the time it was very remote. But as they were there for 70 years, they became part of the fabric of both the Ogden Valley and northern Utah. And many people who have lived their whole lives in northern Utah will remember going to the monastery to visit the monks. They sold bread and honey and other things that they produced there. That's how they earned their living. And so it's sort of this beautiful, iconic property.
So why is your organization interested in helping something that really doesn't benefit those of us here in Summit and Wasatch County?
Well, the Summit Land Conservancy has been getting more and more calls from landowners from all along the Wasatch Back, from Wasatch to Morgan to this is Weber County. And it's really only a 1-hour drive from Park City to get up there. And so the organization, the Summit Land Conservancy, made the decision to go ahead and serve these communities if we could. Now, up there in the Ogden Valley, there is an all-volunteer land trust, and they've been there for about 20 years. They've accepted grants or donations of conservation easements, but they've never bought a conservation easement. And in this situation, the property was so expensive and the way the landowner acquired it, we needed to raise, you know, some significant funding. So in this situation, this landowner had worked with the Summit Land Conservancy to save 90 acres in Hennifer. So we completed that transaction with him in 2019. And so he and his partner felt like, I mean, they knew us, they knew our organization, and they asked if we would help. And we thought it would be really a great opportunity to partner with this all-volunteer group because they know people in, obviously, in their own county. And there will be a community fundraising aspect to this. And we just think it's important that people understand what land trusts do, you know, that we actually do save land. The other part of this is in order to save it, it required, you know, another huge federal grant of the magnitude that the Osgathorpe 160 grant was. And an all-volunteer organization didn't really have the capacity to put in that kind of a federal grant. So the Summit Land Conservancy wrote that grant, and we were here today because we've learned that that grant has been awarded, and that's $8.8 million.
So what's the total price then that you had to buy the easement for?
So the total project cost, which includes the purchase price plus transaction costs, is $9.5 million, a little over $9.5 million.
And again, that's just stopping any development from happening there.
Exactly.
Right. It's they would retain ownership.
Since they've bought it, the Monks had a life estate, which meant they could live there as long as they wanted. But in 2017, the Monks all moved off of the property and into a place where they could get a little more care. They were all over 80 years old. So the Monks have not been on the property, haven't been living on the property. The landowner has still been very interested in making sure that if the Monks felt like they needed to be there, or Monks, there's a little retreat house if they wanted to go there. And so making sure that the property is still available for the Monks.
Yeah. So what is Summit Land Conservancy bringing here to the table?
Well, the ability to write a big federal grant, for one. You know, we're really happy to be working in partnership with this other sister land trust to save something that's important to the community all across Northern Utah.
So are you hoping then that they are able to bring in the other $700,000 to make this happen?
You know, a portion of it will come from other grants, but yeah, we do hope that they will bring in, you know, through a fundraising campaign in the Ogden Valley, a fairly significant amount of money. You know, in this situation, the landowner is donating 58% of the easement value, which is pretty astounding.
And how does that compare with like the Osgathorpe? What did they donate?
You know, landowners generally, and there was a different rule at the Farm Bill about how much landowners could donate. But often our landowners, it's somewhere between about 35 and 25% that they donate. So this is a big contribution from this landowner. He's also spent millions of dollars installing new irrigation systems. People might remember if they'd been up there were these old surplus Quonset huts, military surplus Quonset huts that formed the cloister and the church. And the landowner looked at renovating and saving those, and it would have been millions of dollars. And they were just filled with asbestos and faulty wiring. And so those buildings have had to come down. And all of that has had, you know, the landowner's just been paying to do that kind of stuff. So, you know, he's really restoring, renovating, upgrading the property so that it can be a long-term organic farm, actually, on over 1,000 acres.
Oh. I've got a couple other issues I want to get to. In terms of open space, last week the Park City Council was considering the enormous cost there of the Arts and Culture District. City staff saying spending the $107 million on the district would essentially delay any other big financial projects, including buying open space for at least another 10 years. We also heard from Council Member Tim Henney said that he didn't really think that there was any open space left to buy in town, and if there was, there isn't much. I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, have we bought all of the open space in Park City that needs to be bought?
There are parcels that people think are protected which are not protected. And I think if those became the discussion or subject to a development agreement, I think the community would be kind of inspired to want to do something to save those parcels. There aren't very many of them. We or people that we know are in conversations with those landowners. You know, we are a nonprofit. We can't compel people to save their land. So we wait until people are ready to do so. And in some cases, you know, they just aren't. So it's a tricky question. There isn't anything right now that's sort of coming down the road. If there was, you would be sure, you could be sure that I would be talking to the council in closed session and saying, wait, save some money. But we don't have anything right now. And of that kind of magnitude. So I think that, you know, there was the big 2020 visioning process that went through, and I'm hearing the council and the proponents talk about how the redevelopment of the Bonanza Corner there can be reconciled with the things that people asked for in that Vision 2020.
All right. I saw a report of a motorbike in Round Valley. Apparently, the driver rode off before anyone could say anything. But you want to remind people that this is a no-no.
It is a no-no. The whole Round Valley area is a non-motorized area. I know that sometimes... So this was a gas-powered motorbike, apparently. So no gas-powered vehicles are allowed other than city vehicles for maintenance or mountain trails vehicles for maintenance or emergency vehicles. So, yes, please no motorbikes in Round Valley. And as people, I think, are aware, there is a certification plan for e-bikes so that people who want to ride e-bikes in Round Valley, they can get a certification from the city. And there's information about how to do that on the city's website.
All right. And finally, you've got your annual breakfast fundraiser happening later this month.
That's right. It's our conservation breakfast. We took that event virtual last year and in a handful of weeks, which gave us all upset stomachs. Anyway, it was really successful. It's a half an hour. You can come as you are. It's at 8:30 a.m. on Earth Day, which is Thursday, April 22nd. We do hope that people will come. We're going to talk a little bit more about, you know, kind of why we are here. And, you know, we don't talk very much about how we save land. And we're going to give people a little bit of information on how this process actually works. And again, I say it every time, but, you know, we can't bring in these big federal grants without the support of individual donors. So when people come to our breakfast and support us, it's how we're able to get these federal grants. So and every gift that we have will be matched by a gift from Will and Carol Hodgman. So we hope people will come. They can register at wesaveland.org.
With no limit on the Hodgman grant? Have they...
There's a $30,000 limit.
Oh, okay.
So it's okay. It's pretty high.
Yes.
That's right.
All right. Again, wesaveland.org, and then you'll provide them the login information that they need to join you.
That's correct. Half an hour, April 22nd.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, we're really excited about this monastery transaction. It takes us into a new partnership with the Ogden Valley Land Trust. We are, and of course, honored by the NRCS, which has, you know, given us another $8.8 million grant.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Cheryl.
Thank you.
Cheryl Fox is Executive Director of Summit Land Conservancy. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 9 o'clock.